a holiday love story with a twist today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. He's from Iran. She's from Texas.
He grew up Muslim and I grew up Christian, and we love each other because of that.
And now her family's trying to make Christmas just a little bit more halal. That story's coming up. Plus, Boston won't have snow this Christmas, but it's got plenty of salt just in case.
So we're walking between giant, what's the term in the business?
Well, we call it a pile. We've got probably about 300,000 tons in the yard.
From all over the globe. Should be enough. And veteran politician Norman Mineta remembers his time in a World War II internment camp for Japanese Americans. His own government did not call him a citizen, but a non-alien.
So that's why to this day, I cherish the word citizen.
Those stories coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, coming to you from a Boston where it got up to about 70 degrees today. Doesn't really make much sense. Still, a bit later, we've got the story of the salt that normally would be on the roads, keeping them from icing up, and the far-flung places around the globe where we get that salt from. First, though, we spotted this article in the Washington Post, and it was an uplifting story, so we thought, hey, come on, it's Christmas Eve. Let's share this with you today. This is actually a love story. Bethany Allen Ebrahimian was born in Abilene, Texas. Rumor has it, by the way, that Abilene has the highest number of churches per capita in the U.S., and that's kind of an important detail because Bethany is now married to a Muslim man. His name is Ruhollah Ebrahimian, and they're both with me from their home in Maryland. Thanks so much for being with us. Bethany, let's start with you. Tell us a little more about growing up in Abilene. Your family, your mom especially, I gather, was not content to just expose you and your siblings to that single Texas cow town, was she?
That's right. So my parents were both professors at a local university. And when I was about 5 years old, my mom just decided to move us to Vienna, Austria, for about a semester, about 6 months, because my dad had a sabbatical. So some of my earliest memories are, you know, speaking German in my little German-speaking preschool, and my mom trying to buy a chicken, and she ended up getting a duck. And she told me later, I didn't remember this at the time, of course, because I was five, but she told me later that she had really hoped that she could show her children a broader view of the world. She herself had grown up in a very small town in Arkansas, and I think that she hoped for something more than that for her kids.
Yeah, so you get back to Abilene. What did Abilene and Texas and the United States suddenly look like to you after that year abroad or that semester abroad?
Well, I was five then, so I think I came back and I was excited to have, like, you know, mashed potatoes. But I went abroad again when I was in college. I went to China and really loved it. And then I moved to China for 4 years. And coming back was very, very difficult then, because I found that, you know, I had always been taught growing up that, you know, as a Christian, I don't think I even knew anyone who wasn't Christian when I was a kid. And I'd always been taught that Christians were the kindest people and the, you know, the best people, the most moral people. And in China, I met so many incredibly kind, loving, good people who weren't Christian and didn't want to be. And I didn't think that they would be better people if they were. And that kind of set me off on what's been a really long journey of learning to appreciate the different cultures and different values.
So, Ruhollah, you were born in Iran and moved to the U.S. 12 years ago. That would have been after 9/11. What brought you to the States, and what have these last 12 years been like?
Yeah, so I came to the States in 2003 to continue my graduate studies.
What are your studies in?
Mathematics.
Okay. And
yeah, so my first exposure was to Yale University, which is where I got my PhD. As an Iranian, my understanding of America was, you know, a place that, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric against the States that coming from the establishment and the government. But I guess most Iranians have an incredibly positive view of the States. So I was actually shocked when I came to the States, seeing that the roads are not, you know, are not perfect, or when you know, you see the bus schedule, it doesn't arrive on time. So that was actually kind of a shock to me.
Yeah, don't get me started on the buses. So how did the two of you meet?
We met at an interfaith dinner at Yale University. We actually met at two interfaith dinners. It took us two to finally start talking to each other.
After dating, you decide to get married. Tell me about telling your parents that you decided to marry someone from a different faith, a Muslim.
Well, originally, when I was telling my parents about this new person that I'd met, I just called him Rue, because I didn't want them to guess where he was from. Just R-O-O, Rue. I'm dating this new guy, Rue. And so they had no idea, and I didn't say anything. And after a couple of months, after I'd talked about him a lot and said what a great guy he was, then I told them that he's Muslim and that he's from Iran. And my parents were definitely concerned.
What did they say their concerns were?
A couple of things, that Muslims oppress women, and that when you marry someone from a different culture, it can cause a lot of problems in the relationship. But right about that time, or maybe a week later, that's when the Boston Marathon bombing happened. And that was a very terrible and tragic event. And there was an uptick in Islamophobia after that, some violence. And Ruhola was assaulted 2 days after it happened. And I called my parents and told them about it. I was obviously very upset, you know.
What was the assault about?
I guess I don't want to talk about it too much in detail. It's hard to prove if something is done as a hate crime because you can't read someone's mind. But we reported it to the police, and you know, some people said it seemed like it could have been a hate crime. We're not sure, but it's the only time that Ruhola has ever been, you know, like attacked.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that regardless of what it was, you know, I told my parents about it, and it helped them understand that he was a human being and that he was vulnerable, and that regardless of what's happening anywhere else right now, you know, in this country, Muslims are really vulnerable people, and it helped them see him as what he is, which is a, you know, a person. And they were, after that, very supportive.
I'm curious, have the two of you had to work through any cultural differences since you've been married?
Yeah. That was actually probably one of the main concerns that I had, probably more than like the religion part, was the cultural differences. I knew that there would be a lot of differences, and there would be a lot of things that we're going to have to deal with.
People ask us if, you know, the differences in our religious backgrounds cause problems. But I really feel that that's kind of the wrong question to ask, because he grew up Muslim and I grew up Christian, and we love each other because of that. It's a strong cornerstone in our relationship.
Mm. So recently there's been this backlash against immigrants and Muslims, and especially Syrians, ever since the Paris attacks. And has it dredged up some of that sense of alienation that perhaps you both once felt? And how are you both tackling that, especially this year around the holidays?
I think Ruhola does a lot better job than I do. I get really, really emotional with it. I guess it's because he's just been dealing with it for the past 12 years, and it's pretty new for me. You know, I'm white and I'm blonde and I grew up Christian. I'm just, you know, I fit in so well in this country.
What about you, Ruhola? I mean, Bethany says you're handling it well. Are you?
Yeah, I think I have trust in this country, and I think over the long run, it's going to be okay. These are all short-term things. Some presidential candidate, even though he's pretty popular now in a party, says some things. It's not going to, you know, short-term, it's going to have some effects, but I know that at the end of the day, we'll get it right.
You're avoiding saying his name like it's Voldemort. That would be Donald Trump, right? Ruhola Ebrahimian and Bethany Allen Ebrahimian, thank you very much for being with us today. It was lovely to meet you both.
Thank you,
Marco.
Argentina's new president has been settling into his job this month. Mauricio Macri now occupies the iconic pink presidential palace in Buenos Aires, known as the Casa Rosada. But he's had to wrestle with the outgoing president, Cristina de Kirchner, over another presidential property, the official Casa Rosada Twitter account. Reporter Irena Caselli is following this social media spat. Is Kirchner reluctant to hand over the reins of power, or does she already have Twitter follower envy?
That's a very good question, actually. I think in a sense you can say that she's probably quite reluctant to hand over power. She wasn't even present at the inauguration ceremony for the new president, which is something that has never happened before in Argentina's democratic history. And the Twitter account went away quite fast, actually. Even before Macri became president, the old Twitter account for the Pink House already transformed itself and changed its description and became an official tribute to former president Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and her late husband and predecessor. We thought that that was going to be the end of it, but then this week a new Twitter account came out at Casa Rosada. Casa Rosada is Pink House, and it is now considered the official Twitter account for the Pink House. It has tweeted many pictures of Mauricio Macri, the new president, inside the presidential house. And it has used very different language, talking about dialogue, an air of change, all buzzwords of President Macri.
Like a lot of so-called real and authentic Twitter accounts, it gets confusing. Who actually has the login and password for the official account for the president of Argentina right now?
We don't know, actually. This was one of the many things that we heard about over these past few days. But that mystery was not solved. But definitely Twitter is a big thing here in Argentina. I mean, the former president used to use it to announce all sorts of policies. And there's a lot of activity going on between the supporters of the new president and those who are still wishing that the old president was in power.
Irene, a couple of weeks ago after Mauricio Macri was inaugurated, there was a photo of him dancing on the balcony of the Casa Rosada. What steps is he taking in these early days of his presidency to set some kind of tone and direction?
Yeah, there's been a lot of changes just over this past couple of weeks. When it comes to the economy, the first huge change came when the president actually lifted currency controls, which had been in place for 4 years. The peso, the Argentinian peso, lost value against the dollar almost immediately. This move was seen as necessary in order to fix the distortions of the economy that had been taking place over these past few years. But analysts on all political sides agree that this will mean some rocky times ahead for Argentina in the short term. But also when it comes to foreign policy, Macri has already set a different tone. He spoke out against Venezuela at a regional summit, calling for Venezuela to free political prisoners. This is definitely changing the sort of pace when it comes to the political setup regionally.
Well, it's the holidays, and of course, things everywhere tend to grind to a halt around the holidays. And down there, it's summer at Christmas time. I suspect a lot of minds in Argentina are not on politics right now.
That's right. There are many things that have to be done, and the president has been moving quite quickly. But, you know, it's hot out here. Christmas is coming up. Lots of people are noticing some changes already because many prices have gone up for food staples like meat. People's minds are on Christmas and everything else, but you can definitely see that there is some change. And many people are also worried about what that change may mean.
How warm is it in Buenos Aires today?
I guess today it's about 30 degrees. It's a little humid and
that's,
it's going to rain
Celsius,
soon.
Right?
Yes, 30 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, so up around 85 degrees Fahrenheit. Yeah, well, you should have a nice Christmas.
Yes, it'll be nice and warm.
Reporter Irene Caselli in Buenos Aires, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It's kind of weird how warm it is in Boston. I know, I've been saying that a lot today. No chance of a white Christmas here, but earlier this year, we broke a record. More than 9 feet of snow fell on us last winter. It seemed like nor'easters slammed into the coast on an almost weekly basis. Our public transit system collapsed. So now that winter's back, we're bracing for more, even if it feels like shorts weather today. And one thing we're going to need is salt, which means mobilizing a global effort. Here is The World's Ari Daniel.
So we're walking between giant, what's the term in the business?
Well, we call it a pile.
I'd call it a mountain. Three mountains of salt, the tallest 65 feet high.
Got probably about 300,000 tons in the yard.
Paul Lam is 72 years old, and he works here at Eastern Minerals, Inc. in Chelsea, near Boston's Logan Airport. He's the terminal manager, which means he oversees the hundreds of thousands of tons of salt coming in and going out for distribution across the state to melt snow and ice.
Oh, yeah. There's plenty of business around when it's snowing.
But I couldn't believe where it all comes from.
We get out of Mexico. We get it out of Ireland. And Tunisia, we just got a shipload from Tunisia.
While Lam answers that call, let me explain. There's a handful of mines in the U.S., but it's costly to transport the salt over land, so Eastern Minerals has to look farther afield. The Mexican and Tunisian salt comes from seawater evaporating in the sunshine. The Irish salt's dug out of a dark mine 1,200 feet deep. All of it melts the snow just fine. But most of the salt I see here is pinkish, and it's traveled all the way from the coast of Chile.
It comes from a mine in the Atacama Desert, 4,500 miles away.
Allison Sakala is a filmmaker who followed the salt's journey from Chile to Boston.
The Atacama is the driest place on Earth, so it's this vast plain of salt, and it's flat, and there's no plants, no water. It's a very extreme environment.
The salt extends for miles, even crossing into Bolivia to the north. It's so bright in the salt desert that the workers cover themselves from head to toe and wear special protective sunglasses. Once the salt's out of the mine, it's loaded onto a ship that travels for 2 weeks up the west coast of South America, through the Panama Canal, up the east coast of North America. And then, as soon as it pulls into the harbor here, the unloading begins. I climb inside the cab of one of the cranes. It's parked between a salt mountain on one side and the ship from Chile on the other. John Martin, the crane operator, is at the helm, his hands and feet moving expertly over the control knobs and pedals. At the moment, he's swiveling the thing back towards the ship.
To me, this is like sitting in the living room, you know, and playing a video game.
Martin's got his eyes on a video screen that shows what's beneath the arm of the crane. A clamshell bucket suspended from the lines, and he's lowering it into the hold of the ship below.
Right now we're getting towards the bottom. The ship itself had 58,000 tons.
On the monitor, we see the bucket land on the salt in the hold.
Okay, now I engage this closing wire, which closes the bucket on the salt.
Martin hoists the crane.
I have to get it up high enough to clear the pile.
And swivels so he's back above the salt mountain.
I just dumped the bucket, yes.
The salt cascades onto the pile below, a soft stream of sodium chloride.
That would have almost filled a 10-wheeler.
It's remarkable to see all the pink cubes of salt being shuttled around by the big machines. But then I remember what it all means, slush, wet socks, and shoveling. When the snow falls here, however, not a speck of it lingers. It just melts when it lands on this island of desert salt. For The World, R.A. Daniel, Chelsea, Massachusetts.
Night has fallen over Asia and Europe, and Santa Claus has already started his rounds to the good children over there. NORAD is tracking his movements as usual. And as usual, Santa set off from his village at the North Pole. But I was surprised to learn today that the North Pole has not always been Santa's home. So I wanted to find out when and how Santa got settled up there, and who better to ask a serious question like this than the world's history guy, Chris Wolfe. So what did you find, Chris?
Well, it's interesting. There's a specific date. The earliest published reference to Santa living at the North Pole is December 29th, 1866, in an edition of Harper's Weekly. There's a cartoon by a guy called Thomas Nast, a very famous cartoonist, and it's in a collection of Christmas images, and with one of the images being a village called Santa Clausville, NP. NP short for North Pole.
So where was Santa before the North Pole?
Well, here's where it gets complicated. Santa's most definitely a child of North America, but he's descended from a variety of immigrants from Europe and the Middle East. His oldest known ancestors are St. Nicholas, who is actually from Turkey, famous for his gift-giving, and the old Teutonic god, Woden, or Odin, who had a big white beard and who rode through the sky at this time of year on his 8-footed grey horse. Then he's got more recent ancestors, of course. These include Father Christmas, who came from Britain, Sinterklaas from Holland, and Kris Kringle from Germany. That's the original pronunciation. And all of them brought toys and gifts to children at this time of year.
Wow, I didn't know any of this. I mean, I knew bits, but I didn't know how it all came together. So Thomas Nast, cartoonist best known for rooting out corruption through his drawings, Tammany Hall and all that. 19th century, how did he figure out that Santa was from the North Pole?
Well, he had a number of clues taken from the latest breakthroughs in science and exploration at the time. Obviously, it had to be somewhere with reindeer. Everyone had known reindeer were Santa's favorite mode of transportation, pulling his sleigh, since the publication in 1823 of the poem A Visit from St. Nicholas, better known, you probably know it as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, which I'll be reading to the kids later, as usual. Then in the 1840s and 50s, there had been a series of expeditions to the Arctic that had really captured popular imagination, you know, and the stories of these adventurers, you know, people like John and James Ross, William Parry, John Franklin, were serialized in magazines like Harper's. But none of them got to the pole itself. So it remained an unknown quantity for decades to come. So it became this kind of mythical, magical place, something like Shangri-La, where anything was possible. So, you know, naturally, given that Santa's European ancestors lived in the far north, it seemed obvious that Santa himself should choose to settle at the most northerly point of North America after he landed here. And it was Thomas Nast who appears to have made this breakthrough. And after getting published in Harper's, his research became widely accepted across North America.
The World's Chris Wolf, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco. Merry Christmas.
A quick look ahead before the news headlines. Coming up in just a few minutes, every year, Halifax, Nova Scotia sends Boston a Christmas tree. It's a way of thanking Bostonians for their help after a massive explosion leveled Halifax.
They were our first responders. They were the outside organized medical relief. They set up actual hospitals in Halifax to help the 9,000 injured people. And they survived in Halifax on the food and goods that were sent from the United States of America.
More on that story is just ahead. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A chance meeting at a World War II internment camp between two boys who would later become leaders in Washington, Alan Simpson and Norman Mineta.
He's one of the dearest friends I have.
Equally so from my perspective.
A friendship that spans more than seven decades and transcends partisan politics. That's coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. If you were walking around Halifax, Nova Scotia on this day back in 1917, you'd have been among the lucky ones. A massive explosion and fireball had leveled the north end of the city 3 weeks earlier. Thousands of people were killed or injured, and many more left homeless. My colleague Carol Hill spoke with Blair Bede, a local historian in Halifax, and he told her what happened that day back in 1917.
There were two ships in the harbor coming towards each other, and communication signals with whistles, confusion, and they ended up one hitting the other. The one it hit was called the Mont Blanc, and the Mont Blanc was loaded with munitions for the war in France, and it burned for about 20 minutes, and the combination of munitions on board, it exploded, causing the largest man-made explosion in a populated area before the dropping of the atomic bomb.
And how far and wide was its impact?
60 miles away in Truro, Nova Scotia, church bells were set to ringing and horses ran wild in the streets from this sort of shock wave that was felt that far away. But debris from the ship that blew up in the air was found in a radius of about 4 miles around the city.
And a big chunk of Halifax was just destroyed and several thousand people died in the explosion.
And part of that is because with the wind force of the explosion, it knocked in houses that were heated by wood and coal-burning stoves, and those buildings burned for days on the material that was in them.
Wow. Who were the first responders back in that day? I doubt they were referred to by that term, but who arrived first to help out?
Well, there were ships of the American Navy and Canadian and the British Navy waiting to go in convoy overseas. So immediately they came to respond. The message on the telegraph brought trainloads of people from surrounding villages and towns in Nova Scotia, the Maritime provinces. But a message sent out actually was received the same day by the governor of Massachusetts. And within 2 days, the Americans arrived.
Yeah, there are a lot of doctors and volunteers from Boston, where we are now. I know they helped out. And some of their letters and handwritten notes about what they found when they went to help out are exhibited at the Nova Scotia Archives. Can you read a bit of them for us?
Well, there was one man, Chet Brown, who was helping with relief, giving out money. He waited on one man in the office yesterday, paid him a money order for $100 and some. And when I asked for something for identification, he said he had nothing. He losing everything. He had a wife and 5 children and a new home, and his wife was in a condition to have another child in the near future. He had 3 boys killed in France since the war started, and the story he told would bring tears to the eyes of the most hardened.
Did he lose his immediate family in Halifax?
He lost everybody in the house, so he was alone.
Your grandmother was alive then. What was her experience?
Both of my grandmothers were alive. One was a housewife in her 30s, and the other was a 16-year-old who just celebrated her birthday with her twin sister. And the 16-year-old was closest to the explosion and tried to help at a local hospital. But as she described it, people had parts falling off of them, and she could not take that and had to run away. My grandmother in her 30s lived with her 6 children in a house, and every window was blown out in the house. And she went out to look for milk, and in the snowstorm she got lost and was caked with snow before somebody found her, knew who she was, and led her back to her home.
It was such an incredible, sort of horrible thing that happened to Halifax. Are the memories of those days a source of pain or strength for Nova Scotians today?
Well, the immediate injuries are gone from view, but people do talk about being brought up in houses where they had, as children, to be very quiet because people's nerves were bad, or they couldn't move the furniture because people were blinded and couldn't see around the house, so you couldn't move anything. So children growing up had a restricted lifestyle in Halifax. As I grew up, I would have seen children of the explosion who were really injured and had great deformities in their faces from the flying glass and debris, and it sort of is our story, and it's a big story of Canada.
And interestingly, each year in Boston, we note the explosion. It's in a more festive way. We're going to play you something and see if you recognize what it is.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1,
light the door!
Well, that's the cheers that are given when they light the Christmas tree on the Boston Commons. It comes from Nova Scotia.
And why does it come from Nova Scotia?
After the explosion, it was still World War I. Then you're into a depression, World War II. It's not till the 1970s and 80s that people start to recall the explosion and people remember what happened to them in the explosion. And Nova Scotia started in 1971 to send a Christmas tree to Boston because, and you use the term, they were our first responders. They were the outside organized medical relief. They set up actual hospitals in Halifax to help the 9,000 injured people. And they survived in Halifax on the food and goods that were sent from the United States of America. And this is our thank you back to the principal city that started the efforts to give relief to Halifax.
This awful explosion happened close to Christmas. Did Nova Scotia do anything about that holiday?
Well, people actually probably lost many things they had prepared in their homes, wrapping up for the soldiers over in the battlefields of France. And with the devastation, a little girl wrote a letter saying that one of the things she wanted was dollies to replace the ones killed in the explosion. So across North America, the newspapers said, let's have the children of Halifax have a Christmas. It was really the United States of America who sent Christmas goods to bring cheer to these injured children who were seen photographed in front of trees with meager decorations, but holding on to little trinkets and dollies and things that were sent from the United States. They wanted them to have a happy Christmas.
Blair Bead is a local historian in Halifax. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Continuing now with selections from our favorite CDs of 2015, I don't know how these guys from Holy Forest figured it out, but they released this track that scratches me in all the right places. West African traditional music, check. Afrobeat, check. A voice that comes out of 1960s American soul, check. Yep, even that. Holy Forest brings together some talented players. Tata Dindin Jobarte, a Gambian master of the kora, alums from the Antibalas Afrobeat Orchestra, and Harlem-based singer Ed Preacherman Holly, making an album that's one of our tops from the past year. Baby, that's the distance between us. And only you know how I feel. Even this great ocean can't divide us. Now that you've seen how I feel. Holy Forest there with a track titled Africa Calling. This next story embodies the very ideas of friendship and goodwill. Alan Simpson served as a Republican senator from Wyoming for nearly three decades. Norman Mineta was a Democratic congressman from California and Secretary of Transportation in the administration of George W. Bush. Mineta and Simpson have been friends for a very long time. The story of how they met starts when Mineta's family was placed on a train bound for Heart Mountain, Wyoming. That was the site of an internment camp for Japanese Americans during World War II. Norman Mineta remembers arriving at Heart Mountain.
And the day we got there, it was really cold. The wind was blowing, sagebrush tumbling along. And as Californians, you know, we had light clothing. And because of the wind, we had that sand silt inside the barracks building. Mm. We had no broom or anything else to clean things up. So with cardboard or whatever we could find, we sort of had to sweep up the silt inside the barracks buildings.
How old were you at the time when this happened, and how did you process all this?
You know, for me, when we heard about the evacuation, I was 10 years old. There were rumors that we were going to Santa Anita Racetrack. It was about 400 miles away. So that meant we were going to be on the train overnight. So, you know, for a kid, that was, oh boy, we're going to be on a train trip overnight. And yet for my sisters and my brother, my parents and the older folks, they knew what the impact of this evacuation and internment might be. The part that I do remember was when those placards were being put up and they were posted on sides of buildings, utility poles, and it said, attention all those of Japanese ancestry, alien and non-alien. And so I had to ask my brother, I said, who's the non-alien? And he said, that's you. I said, well, why isn't the government calling us citizens? So right away, you realize that the government was already using psychological warfare on us, and they wouldn't even acknowledge us as citizens. And that's why to this day, I cherish the word citizen, because my own government wasn't willing to refer to me as a citizen, but as a non-alien. Now, I don't know how many times any proud U.S. citizen has stood up and pounded his chest and said, I'm a proud non-alien of the United States of America. So that's why to this day I cherish the word citizen.
Now, Alan Simpson, you lived in Cody, Wyoming, grew up there. What are your memories of the Heart Mountain internment camp? I mean, it was just down the road from you. And how had it all been explained to you by your family and neighbors?
Well, first of all, Norm and I are the same age. We were 10 when the war started. We were 12 when we met. And we were stunned as I think the president, don't forget, Franklin Roosevelt signed this order, one of the great civil libertarians of our time, don't forget, went to the U.S. Supreme Court. They said it was a military necessity. These things happened out of war and hysteria and racism. So suddenly in the sagebrush flat. There was nothing out there between the town of Powell, which is 21 miles away, and Cody. Suddenly, a huge army of people came and erected a series of barracks made out of tar paper shacks, and 11,000 people suddenly came to this camp. And you're a kid, and you're driving to Powell, which was practically a dirt road, and suddenly the third largest city in Wyoming is sitting out here in the flat under Heart Mountain. It was surrounded by barbed wire and guard towers with soldiers in the towers with machine gun mounts. And you're thinking, who wants to go in that place? Why would you? All the guns are aimed inside. But we had a very remarkable scoutmaster, and he said there are Boy Scout troops out there, and we're going to go out there. And he said, if any of your parents don't want that, you have them tell me. Only one parent objected. My parents said, get on out there. These are American citizens. These are kids just like you, 12-year-old kids reading those same terrible little books and all that. And so that's where I met Norm when I went out for one of those jamborees.
But it just sounds like, as a 10-year-old, Alan Simpson, your interpretation of this internment camp was just confusing for you?
How could it be anything else? There was a restaurant in Cody, Wyoming, said, no Japs allowed. You sons of bitches killed my son on Iwo Jima. They'll say, how could this happen? It's easy. It's hysteria and racism. As a kid, you had on your wall a picture of Tojo and Hitler and Mussolini, and you threw darts at those figures all day.
So, Norma Mineta, even though this internment camp was a completely abnormal part of your life, even in the camp, you had a Boy Scout troop at Heart Mountain.
When we first got to Heart Mountain, the schools hadn't been built, and our camp elders were concerned about how to keep us busy and stay out of trouble. So they had written to the Boy Scouts of America and Girl Scouts and said, please come and organize troops in our camps. And invariably they'd say, well, no, we're not going in there. There's barbed wire around the camp. There's machine gun towers and searchlights. We're not going in there. They're POWs. And our scout leaders wrote back and said, no, these are not POWs, these are Boy Scouts of America. They wear the same uniform you do, read the same manual you do, go after the same merit badges you do. So eventually the troop from Cody, Wyoming came in, and we did our normal knot tying contest, and then we got paired off and to put up a pup tent. So we put up our pup tent.
Who did you put your pup tent up with? With Alan Simpson?
It turned out to be Alan. And so our friendship has started then in that little pup tent, and it's endured to this day.
Alan Simpson, how often were you able to go into the camp and hang out with Norman and his family? I mean, was it free access or was it hard?
No, not often. I'm glad Norm left out the point that in our tent there was a bully down below and it was raining, and we directed our little moat down into that guy's tent. And then he said that I laughed hysterically. This is not true. He was laughing just as hard as I was.
I've been speaking with veteran politicians and lifelong friends, Alan Simpson and Norman Mineta. They met at a Japanese internment camp in Wyoming when they were kids. Mineta's family was placed there during World War II, and Simpson lived nearby. Mineta remembers the indignities of the camp.
All the males of draft age had to complete a questionnaire, and question number 27 was, do you forswear allegiance to the Emperor of Japan and swear allegiance to the United States of America? And many of the people said, look, I never swore my allegiance to the emperor in the first place, so why do I have to forswear that? But to me, the amazing thing is that there were close to 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry who were forcibly removed from their homes, put into these camps for the duration of World War II, and there wasn't really rancor or bitterness that came out of the community, but a very strong feeling or attitude that something like this should never, ever happen again to anybody else. And I think the Japanese-American community stuck by that belief.
You certainly did, because years later, when you and Alan Simpson were lawmakers in Washington, you both sponsored legislation to acknowledge the thousands of Japanese-Americans imprisoned in internment camps during the 40s. It was passed in 1988. Alan Simpson, tell us about that bill and what you aim to address.
First, let me just say, at least with my pal, there's a word, a Japanese word for endure, and it's gaman. Is that the pronunciation, Norm?
Right.
Gaman means endure. These people were, it's in their DNA to endure. But the interesting thing about Norm, he's much like, in a sense, Nelson Mandela, who was in Robben's Island and came out without a shred of bitterness. And Norm came out of this experience without a shred of bitterness. But back to the reparations bill, well, no one was ready to do anything after the war. There was not a thought of reparations. I can promise you that. I never heard a peep out of anybody. But finally, and Norm can tell, they worked silently, I think, for years. And finally they brought it forward, and then there was discussion about how much per person. It was a heavy debate, and my colleague from Wyoming, a fellow senator, he was not in favor of the reparations bill at all. He said, who's next? The Native Americans? How about the Shoshones and the Arapahos over in the reservation? How about blacks in the South? Well, I tell you, it got pretty hot, and I said, well, we'll have to part on this one, pal, because I was there and I saw it and lived right next to it.
Well, the bill that was passed in 1988 clearly is a statement that these internment camps should never happen again to anybody. Today, as you've both pointed out, you're still friends. You've both traveled the world to tell this story. I'm just curious to know from you both, as politicians, your reactions to suggestions from some corners of this country that an internment camp is an idea that is relevant again today. Norman Mineta, your reaction.
Well, I just oppose it totally, because it's again reminiscent of this whole incident that occurred in 1942 and ought not to be occurring today. I think that's why so many Japanese Americans are speaking out in opposition to the idea of rounding up Muslims, because again, whether you're a Jewish person in Poland in the late 30s or, again, the roundup of all people of Japanese ancestry, and it just shouldn't happen to any other group based on their ethnicity or their religion.
Alan Simpson, what do you tell Americans who are filled with this fear of the other entering this country and this whole idea that internment camps is one way to deal with that fear?
Well, it's the most absurd way to deal with it. It's if we would just deal honestly with honest immigration reform, do something with the 11 or 12 million people that are here, get them on a path to the green card or temporary residency or something, and then on to the, you know, to the chain of eventual citizenship. But don't forget, America has always stood with its arms open when things are going great. And when things tighten up, the Statue of Liberty folds her arms. And right here in America in the early 1960s, and Norm and I were brash 30-year-olds then, right here in this county, right between Powell and Cody, in the beet fields, was a thing called Operation Wetback. Try that one on. Round up the Mexican Americans who were here illegally and deport them back to Mexico, and that was called Operation Wetback. Now, that's America. Don't think it's ever gone away. And with political correctness, it can hide in the cancer like a fissure in a volcano. So, you know, as people wring their hands and say, oh, my sakes, I've never had a bad thought in my life. Forget it. Political correctness is like wearing duct tape over your mouth, and got to deal with it.
Alan Simpson and Norman Mineta, thank you both very much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Nice being with you, Marco.
Thank you very much. He's one of the dearest friends I have.
Equally so from my perspective.
Our wives have a little trouble with us. We see each other, we hug and kiss and break our glasses, carrying them in our pocket, of course, but we have a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'll bet they do. What a story. Former Senator Alan Simpson and former Congressman and Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta. You can see pictures of their 70-plus year friendship at PRI.org. The video for this song will put you in the mood for a tropical vacation. This is Somos Dos from the Colombian band Bomba Estéreo. We love these guys and their lead singer Liliana Somet. Their 2015 album Amenacer did not disappoint. It made our list of favorite releases. Here's more from Bomba Estéreo.
Necesito sino abrazarte para sentirlo y ya no tengo que esperar para saberlo. Cuando el amor es amor, es amor, es amor, es amor. Cuando el amor es amor, es amor, es amor, es amor.
Colombia's Bomba Estéreo. The full list of our favorite music of 2015 at PRI.org. Our own theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg and, oh yeah, remixed this past year. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. We'll be back here tomorrow. I'll see you then, but if you've got other plans, here's wishing you a very Merry Christmas.
PRI, Public Radio International.